This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Historic Souvenirs presents Spitfire by B.J. Allen. In the programme Historic Souvenirs, Free FM 89.0 broadcasts excerpts from the book Spitfire by B.J. Allen. Printed in wartime Britain with the publisher's note, the proofs of this book had to be passed for press subsequent to the author's departure for service overseas, 1942. As a young pilot in Britain from the outset of World War II, he knows the war will inevitably soon consume the world in a fight against fascism. One evening in the warmth of summer, another pilot, wondering what to do, having eaten at the mess, before we turn in for the night, ready to react to any dawn raid, calls me over. I join him, strolling in the garden outside the mess. See here, what does this remind you of? It's been an unusual day of intense engagement, when a superior enemy force flying out of the sun might have mauled us badly. Luftwaffe now flies stronger escorts to protect its bombers, but without the battle experience to match Spitfires flown by veterans. It's bizarre that the encounter might be so brief that a sky filled with warplanes is in the next moment empty of aircraft except our own. My companion, also a pilot, relives the experience. There wasn't time to see anything. I just fired when something came into my sights, turned like hell as something fired on me. It seems amazing that all of ours survived that encounter unscathed. What's the matter? I ask. He blurts out. I got one in flames. Poor swine got stuck halfway out of his cockpit. A rotten sight. His gaze shifts skywards. Another pilot joins us. What does that remind you of? I look upward. Here I see a cloud of gnats. Silently they mill about in the evening air, seeking. If a mosquito should arrive, I wonder what they'll do. We go inside to our own mess, the one we'd known before Dunkirk became the squadron's focus. The station commander promised us 48 hours leave when we get back. Let's see if we'll be let to sleep on. I sleep in, a rare luxury when at war. It's no joke. The station commander, true to his word, grants leave. Feeling happy and carefree to survive till now. I'm phoning my wife to pack the car for 48 hours bliss together away from war. After lunch in the mess, I take my coffee to await her arrival. She wastes no time, as I've hardly settled to enjoying my drink, when I see our little grey Lancia coming up the drive. The golden head of hair puts it beyond all doubt. It's her. Come to meet me, all right. I dash off to my room to collect my kit and go on our way. Only then does it impact on me. Despite sleeping in, I'm suddenly tired, tired as only those who are under constant tension can know. It's the effect of pilots waking at 3:15 a.m. to get ready to fly on dawn patrol. 10 days in a row, getting to bed about 11, tossing and turning till midnight. The roar of takeoff at first light, squinting into a rising sun, where an enemy patrol may be on the prowl. All too soon, 2 days home leave is over. Yet the aerodrome seems rather inactive. Before long, however, the Luftwaffe resorts to night raids. To combat this, one flight goes on standby during the hours of darkness. On June the 19th, 1940, sound of aviation engines reverberates overhead. Those on standby scramble to try to find the nocturnal raiders. about an hour before midnight, strolling near the mess with a squadron leader, we scan the night sky. From high above, we hear a faint whistling sound grow to crescendo. Then a crump as the bomb buries itself about a mile away. We brace for an explosion, but none comes. Just as well, it's a dud. A bevy of bombs follows, creeping closer to deliver a different impact on us. We're caught unawares. Their explosion rattles the windows in the mess. We look into the dome of heaven as intense beams probe the darkness, lingering on a silver target, one of the enemy raiders. A brief flicker of flame shows high above. What I take to be two puffs of smoke, they materialize into two parachutes as its crew abandon their stricken aircraft, now trailing smoke, as it heels over, plunging earthward, impacting in a huge flash. Unfortunately, when the British searchlight exposes the Spitfire attacking the German raider, the enemy rear gunner, glimpsing the British fighter, opens fire on it, setting a fuel tank on fire. As flames engulf the Spitfire, its pilot bails out, but suffers bad burns. It'll be many months before they heal to let the pilot resume his place on the squadron. However, the German raider is also doomed, tracked by searchlights, facing anti-aircraft fire from another Spitfire till it runs out of ammunition. As the Heinkel goes into a dive, its crew brace to ditch in the sea, close to the coast where their rescue brings the Germans onto our Spitfire station. Their captain comes across as a real gentleman, but the same can't be said of his crew. So they are taken away while their officer is invited into our mess. He accepts the chance to clean himself up in the vacant room of one of our pilots. Imagine our pilot's shock to find, after breakfast in the mess, there's his room and razor now in the hands of a German officer of the Luftwaffe. While I'm talking to him, waiting for the authorities to arrange the German's internment, it's my turn for astonishment. As arranged, my wife arrives to meet me. On catching sight of her coming, the German officer tells me he knows her. At first I think I'm misunderstanding, but no. He'd seen her in Germany before World War II. They share a common interest in motor racing. It's now the night of June the 26th, 1940. Our flight is on standby. How I envy the pilots whose sleep comes easily. Their snores sound around the dispersal hut as I am lying awake, ears attuned to drones of German aircraft somewhere to the south. It's just after midnight when I grope about and eventually find the phone ringing. Hello. Hello.
Take off. Take off.
I tumble off the bed to go out into the night. Somewhere out in the dark, an engine starts up, spoiling the stillness. I peer in front of me, trying to pick out blue exhaust flames to show where my aircraft is. A tender rumbles on its way to the aerodrome. It's the flare path officer, going to light up the runway for me to take off. As I approach the Spitfire, I stop a moment to listen. It's the music of a Merlin at full throttle as the fitter tests the engine. It's performing perfectly, sounding much louder now than with the distractions of daylight. The fitter lets the engine subside. As I bend down to click home the leg straps of my parachute, more straps which he hands to me, I'm shrugging my shoulders to feel more comfortable in their harness. Okay, sir? Okay. The fitter jumps to the ground. I heave onto a wing to step into the cockpit, settling in its seat. Turn up lights on cockpit instruments till their orange glow allows a check of coolant, oil pressure, and temperature. I run up the engine and taxi out. Everything okay. I jerk my thumb over my shoulder, then wait for the torch flash from behind that signals the crew are holding down the tail, ready for me to open the throttle. I do, slowly, till at maximum. A final check of boost pressure and revs, then pull the lever back to let me wave a hand above my head to signal the crew, run back to the wingtips. Another flash from a torch tells me the chocks in front of the wheels are all pulled away to begin to taxi. Out in front of me, the faint line of lights shows the flare path. I switch off the cockpit lights so as to see better and flash my light to ask permission to take off. An answering flash. I'm moving slowly forward. A slight turn to point directly along the glimmering line of lamps. A glance around the cockpit to make sure all's in order. I open the throttle, gathering speed into the black void of night. The last of the line of lights flashes past as the Spitfire takes to flight as I watch the instruments for flying blind. The undercarriage up, I reset the airscrew pitch and close the radiator slightly. My altimeter shows 1,500 feet. I search for the horizon. A faint demarcation showing where earth and sky meet. Overhead, a crystal canopy of stars. Visibility, a good 12 miles. Dark, but not quite blackout. I shan't need to fly by instruments. I switch on the RT to call up the controller. His voice comes crackling back.
Receiving you, okay. There are some Huns east of you.
I acknowledge the message, turning east as I do. Climb towards a bank of cumulus cloud overhead. Hearing a new source of sound, the searchlight gropes about seeking us out. Apparently, the searchlight crew below become satisfied that I'm a friendly aircraft, and they switch off. As I come out of the top of the cloud, all's dark again, save the stars overhead. At 15,000 feet, I flatten out and steer towards a group of searchlights, obviously trying to pick up an elusive Hun. Cruising around just behind them, I wait, peering at the beams in the hope that I might actually see a faint silhouette, even if the enemy aircraft is not actually illuminated. For an hour and a half, I follow various groups of searchlights, but without any luck. Then a voice in my phones tells me to come back and land. I turn and begin to lose height, following the courses I'm given until I'm fairly near the aerodrome. Down to 1,000 feet, and I begin looking round for the flare path. Over on my left, a line of lights shines out. Good show, I'm nearly home. Circling the aerodrome, I flash on the light for permission to land. An answering light shines out. And I begin my approach. Wheels down. Wheels down. Throttle back a little. 120 miles per hour. Okay. Flaps down, and I turn at the downward end of the flare path. A light glares out below me as the searchlight switched on, lighting up half the aerodrome. I straighten up, losing height all the time until my altimeter shows 100 feet. About 50 yards short of the floodlight, I open the throttle a little and begin to ease the stick back. There's a terrific bump. Oh, blast, I misjudged it. I'm too low. I give a burst of throttle to ease the aircraft down off the bounce, wondering if my undercart's all right. I'd certainly hit the ground fairly hard. As I pass the floodlight, there's a much softer bump and I'm down. Running down the flare path, the left wing begins to sink, so the undercart can't take it. I'm not altogether surprised. Lower and lower the wing sinks until the tip touches the ground and the aircraft slews around, the nose dug in, and we come to a shuddering standstill. I switch off, climb out feeling furious with myself, and walk back towards the tender coming to pick me up. As it stops, I climb in and sink down in the seat, feeling very tired. The flare path officer comes up and climbs aboard. Bad luck. You certainly hit the ground a wallop. You're telling me. I nearly swallowed my teeth. I sit back as we drive back to the huts, cursing myself. A fine example I'm setting the rest of the flight. A flight commander is supposed to be past that sort of thing. Next morning, the commanding officer speaks to me. Bad luck, that show of yours. I'm not altogether surprised, though. You'd been flying all day, and then, on top of that, a couple of hours at night. You were just too tired. I get some comfort from that. But I still feel a twerp.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire, while the breeze on high sang a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire, under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above. You'd be so nice, you'd be paradise to come home to and love. It's not that you're fairer than a lot of girls just as pleasing, that I doff my hat as a worshipper at your shrine. It's not that you're rarer than asparagus out of season. No, my darling, this is the reason why you've got to be mine. You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire, while the breeze on high sang a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire, under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above. You'd be so nice, you'd be paradise to come home to and love.
July and August come and go, and the autumn's beginning to draw on. But still we have no action. The blitz has begun down south, and we're beginning to wonder if we're going to miss it. Up to this time, the squadron had been going out each day to an aerodrome near the coast to carry out convoy patrols. August the 16th, 1940, finds us basking in the sun and hoping some German would come in and give us something to do. Nothing much has been happening all day, and as tea time approaches, we toss a coin as to which flight should go up to the mess for tea first. I lose for A flight, and we stay there on the sunlit aerodrome until B flight should return. After about a quarter of an hour, the phone rings. The squadron's to return home. I tell them B flight's up at the mess and ask whether we should go off by ourselves or wait for the others to finish their tea.
A flight's to go off now.
We take off and circle the aerodrome, climbing for height. Then a voice comes through.
Climb to 1,500 feet. There might be some trade for you on your way back.
We set course and climb up through the sunlit haze and broken cloud. We fly on for some minutes until I judge we must be near the coast. Then, from behind a bank of cloud, sail five Heinkels. Then another five, and another. A steady stream of aircraft appearing from the cloud, reminding me of a huge chorus coming out onto the stage from the wings. There must have been at least 150 of them, Heinkels and Messerschmitt 110 fighters. And way above shows 12 thin white pencils of smoke, the top escort. The leader of the formation must have seen us a few seconds after I sighted his formation. For the Germans turn out to sea, thin trails of black smoke from their exhaust showing that they had opened their throttles wide and were on the run. The humour of the situation strikes me. My God, what a windy bunch. We're overhauling the Germans fast, and the rearguard of Messerschmitt 110s turns back to meet us, blocking our way to the bombers. Ah, there are at least 20 of them. The old excited feeling flutters at the pit of my stomach. I remember getting exactly the same feeling stepping into the boxing ring at school. Thoughts race through my mind. How can we get to those bombers? I glance up at the white trails far above us. They hadn't seen us, or else they thought we were a decoy and won't come down. Ahead, the Messerschmitt 110s are circling to meet us. I glance back. Could one section of ours hold off the fighters while the others streak after the bombers? No, we'll have to leave the Heinkels and content ourselves with a crack at the fighters. The leading Messerschmitt is abreast of us now, turning to come in behind us. I wheel first, and another section goes to meet him while I head to cut off some of the others. A Messerschmitt 110 turns and comes straight at me from above, six streams of tracers spurting from his nose as he opens fire. Not a very experienced pilot, judging by the range at which he opens fire, and I turn my head to see his tracer going 50 yards behind me. As he flashes past, I stall turn to come in behind him, and the rest of the section breaking away, each picking out an opponent. I dive after mine, and as he turns left, I pull round inside him, get the deflection, and press the fire button. Oh, I miss him, and he pulls hard round and goes underneath me. I turn again in time to see another Spitfire on his tail. A burst of tracer, and the German goes down in the dive, steeper and steeper, and finally plunging vertically downwards, disappearing into the clouds far below. Good, that one's down. He obviously couldn't pull out of that dive. The clouds are only a couple of thousand feet up. Turning again, I climb up towards two more Germans, getting into position behind one of them. As I get there, he sees me and begins twisting and turning his way, and that whilst I strive to get my sights on and take a steady enough aim to fire. At last, he's right in the centre of my sight, and I open fire. One gun immediately stops. Blast it! I'm not out of ammunition yet. Must be a stoppage. It looked as if I was hitting the Messerschmitt, but he still twisted in front of me, and I break away to get into a better position. As I do so, another Hun comes round on my tail, and we start circling in what the Germans so aptly term a Kurvenkampf. The Spitfire has a much better turning circle, and as I begin to gain on him and come round towards his tail, he breaks away into the opposite turn. It's a silly manoeuvre, as it brings me onto his tail almost at once. I fire the rest of my ammunition. He breaks away below me, and I lose him from sight. Feeling rather annoyed at having had no luck, I dive away towards the clouds. Glancing behind me, the fight appears to be almost over. Away to the right, a Messerschmitt is driving homewards. A Spitfire turns away from behind him and heads back towards the coast. The clouds below come rushing up to meet me, and suddenly the dazzling white vapour blots out the sun and sky. Concentrating on the instruments, I dive on down, the cloud getting gradually darker, until below a different shade of grey tells the sea is beneath us. The cloud thins abruptly, and I'm out in the clear. It's very misty down here, and for a while I can't pick up the horizon. The artificial horizon has been upset in the dogfight and it's not working. The altimeter shows 2,000 feet. I can tell I'm still diving fast by the sound of the airstream and the noise of the engine without looking at the airspeed indicator. I ease back the stick and look at the turn and bank indicator. I'm in quite a steep turn. Pushing the stick over to one side, I get the kite more or less straight and then a lightship appears to my right. It looks rather unusual, as it seems to be floating at an angle of 45 degrees. I still aren't straight yet,
and correcting still more until the ship's in a normal position, I look ahead and see the line of breakers on the shore and line up my wings on this horizon. The beach and cliffs slip by underneath. I recognize a town to the south. 270 degrees should be just about right to get home, and resetting the gyro from the magnetic compass below it, I sit back and settle down on the course, idly watching the fields and lanes disappearing slowly beneath the wings. I feel we've been on the job again, and after a couple of months inactivity, it's like a tonic. I'm annoyed with myself for not getting anything. My eye must be a bit out. Oh, well, wait till we get back and see B-flight spaces. This'll teach them to go and have D first. A town comes into view beside the engine. Funny, I don't recognize it, and I should be over familiar ground by now. I circle, trying to pick up some features I know. From the look of the country, I know it's somewhere south of the aerodrome, but I'm not quite sure whether east or west. Just then, I hear the ground station at the aerodrome calling another aircraft. Waiting until they've finished, I call up and ask for a course home. On to the new course, and the countryside begins to look more familiar. Another transmission for a check bearing, and I know where I am. The aerodrome appears in front of me. I dive down across it and come into land. Round the tail of one of the aircraft. All the rest of A-Flight are down and are talking to the aerodrome intelligence officer.
Never in the field of human conscience was so much owed by so many to so few.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.